I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Thousands of Rohingya have been fleeing Myanmar and have told harrowing stories of brutality, accusing the military of targeted killings, of arson, rape, and ethnic cleansing as part of a violent crackdown on this Muslim minority. They've been living under severe restrictions for years, stripped of their citizenship in 1982, and have been described as one of the most persecuted minorities in the world. Nobel Peace Prize laureate Malala Yousafzai called on fellow Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, who's a civilian leader in Myanmar, to speak out about the plight of the Rohingya. Suu Kyi has been criticized for staying silent about the Rohingya and has said the crisis is being distorted by a, quote, huge iceberg of misinformation. Today we hear about the history of the Rohingya, why they are being persecuted, and what the global community can do. Joining us is Azeem Ibrahim, senior fellow at the Center for Global Policy and author of a book called The Rohingyas Inside Myanmar's Hidden Genocide. He joins us by Skype. Azeem Ibrahim, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
Also with us is Hamila Hanan, and she's a human rights activist, director of the crowdsourced hashtag We Are All Rohingya Now campaign. Jamila, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Azeem, let me begin with you, and I think we need to put a little history on the table before we talk about what's going on today. Here's a very basic question for you. Who are the Rohingya that have been living in Myanmar?
Well, the Rohingya are a group, a minority ethnic group that live in western Myanmar in the Rakhine district. They have been living there from the 8th century. They have been basically an indigenous people, and they are now essentially the minority of choice of persecution. One of the reasons why is because they actually are very different from the rest of the population. They look different, they have a different religion, they have a different language. And since the military coup, 1962, they have essentially been the minority of choice to bear the brunt of the Myanmar state for persecution.
And would you say that they are persecuted because they are Muslim living in a Buddhist majority country?
Well, there's a wide variety of reasons why they're actually persecuted, but that's certainly one of the reasons, is because they are the largest ethnic minority group within Myanmar itself. And as I said previously, they've always been the minority of choice of persecution. There are other minorities that also get persecuted to the same kind of extent, but none of them get the kind of coverage that the Rohingya get, simply because of the numbers of the Rohingya. You know, they're the largest minority.
And do they look different? You mentioned the fact that they are different.
Yeah, they look different. They don't have the Mongolian kind of features that the majority of Myanmar people do. They do have Bengali type features from that region, and so they do look different. They have different skin color, they have a different language, and they have a different religion. So that makes them stand out quite dramatically from the rest of the population, leading to increased persecution.
And living in a specific part of Myanmar, yes?
That's right, yeah. So they've all essentially come from the Arakan region, also known as the Rakhine region, which is in the northwestern part of the country. So they've all originated from there. And as I mentioned before, you know, they've actually been there for centuries, and there's documented proof of that.
Jamila, let me get you in on the conversation. Tell us about this 1982 law that went into effect, imposing very strict restrictions on the Rohingya.
Yes, well, up until then, many of the Rohingya did actually have citizenship. And what I understand is that law removed their right to citizenship. Really, it has become impossible for them to now give the necessary proof for them to have citizenship. And so since that date onwards, they became stateless people and have since been campaigning for the return of their citizenship. So without citizenship, they're really extremely vulnerable and not covered by the laws of the land.
Meaning what? They can't work? They can't vote? What are those restrictions about?
Over the years, the restrictions on them seem to have got worse and worse, especially in recent years. And so some of the restrictions that were imposed on them was the number of children that they could have, the right to marry. It became very difficult for them to get married even. Land that they could own, they're not allowed to travel. They need a special permit to travel from one place to another. And increasingly, their life has just become impossible. And in recent years, many of them have been driven into internment camps. Some people call them concentration camps. Mm. The Myanmar regime say that it's for their safety, but really everybody knows that these are just like prisons. So unbearable living conditions, really. And then recently what has happened is a full-scale ethnic cleansing operation, really, to completely remove them from the area.
Well, and what we're hearing is in the last 2 weeks or so, more than 100,000 Rohingya have been fleeing, many of them for Bangladesh. Azeem, let me go back to you. What was behind this sort of latest attack on the Rohingya?
Well, the military claimed that there was an attack by a militant organization called ARSA, which is the Arakan Rohingya Solidarity Army. They undertook an attack on a border post on the 26th of August, which was the trigger by which the military ensured a clampdown on the Rohingya villages. So essentially what the military did is that they evacuated all the Buddhists out of the area and did not evacuate a single Rohingya or Muslim from the region. And then subsequent to that, you know, they undertook overwhelming force to attack not just the militants, but civilians in particular. And from that, we've seen literally hundreds of villages have been burnt to the ground. Human Rights Watch has obtained satellite images showing that, you know, 80%, over 100 kilometres, 80% of the villages had been burnt down. Altogether, 2,600 homes had been completely destroyed. And this has led to 120,000 Rohingya fleeing into neighbouring Bangladesh. And the difficulty for the military trying to justify this narrative is that the military build-up actually happened months before this attack even took place. And the Arakan Rohingya Solidarity Army is actually a very little-known entity, which doesn't really have much significance in the larger scheme of things. You know, it's relatively quite new, even though they themselves claim to be a much older organization. Is relatively new, but the response of the military has been overwhelming, and it was essentially an excuse. You know, I think most people believe it was simply an excuse to actually clamp down on this. And in fact, I should just add that the army chief, General Mina Aung Ling, has actually said that sorting out this Bengali problem — they refer to the Rohingya as Bengalis because they believe that they're illegal immigrants from Bangladesh — he said sorting out this Bengali problem is long overdue, and you know, we're just undertaking unfinished business from the Second World War.
But this Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, they did kill, I think, something like 12 members of the Myanmar military. Is that correct, Azeem?
They killed a number of members of the Myanmar military, police, and security forces. That's absolutely correct. But it's a relatively new organization. The Rohingya have historically been completely non-violent organization. In fact, Aung San Suu Kyi, when she came to power, she set up a number of commissions to try to tackle the civil wars. There's a number of organizations that have engaged in civil war with the state of Myanmar for decades. And these are all violent organizations. And the Rohingya were not included in that, because they were not perceived to be a violent organization. Hmm. They've actually been the least violent of all the minorities in Myanmar. So this is quite a recent new phenomena, and it bears the frustration the people are actually facing.
Gemma, I heard a BBC report, and it was a report from the government of Myanmar saying that they have not been, they're not responsible for what has been happening in the last couple of weeks. They deny abuses. They deny burning down villages. They say that all this was done by these militants. What do you say in response to that? And how do we know that? Because it's very difficult for journalists, for instance, to get into this region of Myanmar to see for themselves what's going on.
There's actually a huge amount of evidence coming out from the area, thanks to many dedicated human rights activists on the ground who are doing a fantastic job sending videos out despite really, really dangerous circumstances. Videos, photos, and testimony, and there's a constant flow of information, which I'm actually logging everything on a data sheet. And when you start cross-referencing and looking at videos from different angles, you can see that this evidence is so overwhelming that you can't just deny it and dismiss it as fake. It's clearly not fake. It's impossible to fabricate this amount of evidence, which is also backed up by the satellite imaging that Human Rights Watch have done that has proven the raising of these villages. And also looking at the now over 123,000 people have now managed to cross their confirmed numbers that have crossed into Bangladesh. We know there's thousands more actually stuck in Myanmar trying to escape, and we know they've got no way out. They're coming across with huge injuries and terrible tales, many, many stories that are consistent of massacres that are taking place, of women, old people, children even, that have been burnt, that have been shot and have been hacked to death. Some of them are even getting shot literally metres from the border of Bangladesh as they're trying to escape. So this amount of evidence, which is confirmed by many human rights organisations, which was also the topic of a flash report by the United Nations, who went and did thorough investigations with the refugees in Bangladesh and confirmed everything that the activists were saying. And in fact, what they reported was even worse than the activists were saying. So there's so much evidence. And Aung San Suu Kyi, really, it's really difficult to understand what she's thinking in just denying this information. One can only think that she has been completely blinkered by the liars that surround her and the propaganda that they're actually fabricating themselves, and not very well, that I've got to say.
About a minute, Azim, before our first break here, Aung San Suu Kyi told the BBC that ethnic cleansing was too strong a word to describe what's been going on in Myanmar. What do you make of that?
Well, Aung San Suu Kyi has denied that the problem ever even actually exists. You know, when she was interviewed by the BBC on repeated occasions, she even refused to use the term Rohingya. She just doesn't believe that the problem actually exists in the first place. So it's not surprising that she's denying that ethnic cleansing is taking place. But further to what Jamila was saying is that there's overwhelming evidence now. You know, I just spoke to somebody yesterday who's actually on the border, and he said that the Myanmar military is actually shooting people as they're actually crossing over the border. And Reuters this morning reported that they're actually laying mines at the border to stop, you know, when the people are fleeing. So this is a systematic, organized campaign of a slow motion genocide and ethnic cleansing by the military of Myanmar. And, you know, this has been confirmed by multiple independent human rights reports and the United Nations and news agencies. So there's no denying that there's a systematic, organized campaign of ethnic cleansing going on against the Rohingya.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Azim Ibrahim, senior fellow at the Center for Global Policy, author of a book called The Rohingyas. At NPR, we say Rohingyas. I hear you saying Rohingyas. I'm sorry about that. Inside Myanmar's Hidden Genocide. Also with us, Jamila Hanan. She's a human rights activist, director of the crowdsourced hashtag We Are All Rohingya Now campaign. She's joining us from England. That's why there's a delay. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoeng, talking with my guests about the crisis in Myanmar, the plight of the Rohingyas. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Azim, let me read a comment from Beverly. She writes, while it is the military that has been murdering the Rohingya in Myanmar's Rakhine State, it is Buddhist monks who have stirred up the extreme hatred and violence against Muslims, notably Emba Tha and its notorious leader Ashan Wirathu. During my visit to Human Rights Partners in Myanmar in February, it was stunning to see how pervasive Wirathu is on Facebook, which has become one of the main ways Burmese get their news in Myanmar. Can you comment about him and what he represents?
Yes, absolutely. And this is one of the most confusing things that people I get asked most often, is that people just don't understand how Buddhism and Buddhist monks and Buddhist followers can actually engage in such violence. You know, Buddhism, after all, is a religion that even when you have bad thoughts, you have to go cleanse yourself. You know, they don't even kill insects, for example. But one thing people don't understand is that the form of Buddhism that Myanmar follows is very different from the Buddhism that you and I might be familiar with. They, for example, do not recognize the Dalai Lama. It's not the Dalai Lama's version of Buddhism. Their Buddhism is what they call Theravada Buddhism, and that's a very much more militant form of Buddhism. And they believe that for Buddhism to thrive, all other ideologies and religions have to be kept in check and have to be suppressed. And they actually believe that the Rohingya, they believe in reincarnation. They believe that the Rohingya have all been reincarnated from snakes and insects. So when you actually kill them, you're not actually killing people. You're actually killing snakes and insects. And in terms of the actual monk Weerathu, he's actually a very strange character himself. Hmm. You know, he's a Buddhist monk who wears a Buddhist orange garb, but at the same time, you see him flying on, you know, private jets, wearing diamond-studded watches. And, you know, he's got all this very expensive designer luggage and so on. And he's described himself to Time magazine a number of years ago as a Buddhist bin Laden.
I read that.
Yeah, so it's very strange. You know, it's a very, very strange. On the one hand, you wear the orange garb, which means that you're actually turning your back on worldly things. On the other hand, he's got like diamond-studded watches and private jets. So it's a real contradiction, I think, in many people's minds who try to follow this closely. But he's actually one of the individuals, as your contributor said, that rightly so is instigating a lot of the violence is actually coming from the monasteries and coming from these monks who believe that the Rohingya are actually usurpers who are there to, you know, dilute Buddhism and take over the country. And this goes back a long way, you know, this history. But the national parties don't actually have a lot of influence in the Arakan region. And so they have to partner with these Buddhist monasteries and clerics to actually have any sort of political traction, which just gives them a lot more credibility and gives them a lot more influence.
But is there a direct relationship between this Buddhist leader and the military, for instance, in Myanmar?
Yeah, the military and the Buddhists have a very, very close relationship. And once again, it goes back to the historical context. You know, one of the reasons why the Rohingya are actually the chosen minority for persecution is because in 1962, there was a military coup in which General Ne Win took power in the country. And he tried to implement what he called the Burmese Road to Socialism, which was a communist manifesto, but it was a complete economic disaster. So he did what essentially a lot of military rulers do, is that they essentially tried to find scapegoats to blame it on, and the Rohingya were the minority of choice. So he made, at that time, you know, Buddhism the state religion of Myanmar. He started funding monasteries. He tried to don the cloak of religiosity and blaming everything that's going wrong in the country on these foreign elements. And the Rohingya were the ones that unfortunately were picked for that. So there's a very close relationship between the military support of these Buddhist monasteries and Buddhist clerics and the persecution of the Rohingya.
Jamla, let me go back to you. I know that former UN Chief Kofi Annan headed up a commission to address some of the divisions, some of the conflicts in Myanmar, issued a report recently. What were some of the recommendations?
Kofi Annan's commission, they've always said that what they've been asked to look at is limited. They've not been asked to look at the human rights violations. They've been looking at ways to promote peace. They've been promoting economic reforms in the area. And it doesn't go anywhere near what is needed, which is a full UN investigation. And there was actually a resolution at the UN calling for a proper inquiry in Myanmar, and the Myanmar government themselves rejected it and would not let UN inspectors into the country. And it seems that this Kofi Annan's report and commission is being used really as a sticking plaster to cover up what's really going on there and the real crimes. And To be honest, I don't personally rate that report at all. I don't think it should be given that much weight, and people shouldn't be looking to that. That's not what's needed, and it's actually partly funded by the Myanmar government itself. So we can't expect anything really solid, in my opinion, to come out from that. What we need to be looking at is a full UN investigation into these crimes, and what Kofi Annan does is a separate issue. That's fine if the Myanmar government want to go along with that, but it's not an excuse, and it's not a solution to what's happening now.
How, though, do you get the United Nations to do the kind of inspections that you want inside the country, especially if the government, the military, wants to prevent something that that potentially problematic for them, Jamila?
Yeah. Absolutely. It is a problem because obviously nobody wants to go in there and actually, you know, start a war. But what they need to be looking at is when a regime or a government does not go along with United Nations recommendations, there has to be some kind of penalty. Mm. They can't just carry along with business as usual. And what we're doing also as a campaign is trying to bring the focus back onto how economics are affecting the situation, the plight of the Rohingya at the moment. There's huge economic investments going into this part of the country in particular. And it's only just this past week, as this has been going on, that the Myanmar government have announced a development zone in this exact area where this is happening. And the same thing happened in a different area where the Rohingya were driven out in 2012. So what we're encouraging as a campaign is to not just look to our governments, not just to look to the United Nations, but let's look to people who are investing in the area. Let's look to multinational corporations who have huge power and influence in the area and encourage them to raise their voice, to speak up for the Rohingya, to see what they can do. When they invest in the country, how can they also protect the Rohingya? And how can they also bring influence on what's happening with the United Nations as well? We think that this element has been neglected, really. You know, let's look at the investors, let's look at the private sector, and let's bring them into the discussion and ask them to live up to certain responsibilities as well.
Azim, do you see this as an effective way to address some of these human rights violations within Myanmar?
I think Jamila is absolutely right. There has to be a full United Nations human rights investigation to actually ascertain exactly what is going on. There has been a resolution passed, but the Myanmar government has simply ignored it. And the difficulty is that the Myanmar government itself has undertaken an investigation, and which they believe was sufficient. It was led by a former military officer. And the conclusion they came to is that there was no human rights violation. The only crime that was committed by the Myanmar military over decades and decades of persecution was that one soldier stole a bike. And that was essentially the conclusion of the entire report. So it was a complete and utter whitewash. Now, Kofi Annan's recommendations, you know, his remit was very limited. He was not permitted to look at human rights violations. He was looking specifically at poverty reduction. I actually advised his commission as well. I gave evidence to his commission. But his recommendations, nevertheless, have been completely ignored as well. You know, I believe they're a good start. But despite that, they have just been completely ignored. And the cynics amongst us, even when this, when his commission was announced, when it was set up by Aung San Suu Kyi, there was many people extremely cynical about this, because after she set up this commission, Aung San Suu Kyi literally 2 weeks later made a trip to the United States, where she addressed the General Assembly at the UN, and then she had a meeting with President Obama at the White House. And President Obama then lifted all unilateral sanctions against Myanmar. So many cynical individuals would say that, well, look, she set up this commission along with many other commissions to say, well, look, I'm doing what I can. You know, I have now commissioned one of the world's greatest diplomats to look at this problem, to try to get to the bottom of it, and we will implement the solutions. And President Obama lifted all sanctions against Myanmar, which is exactly what the military was actually looking for in years, to get the sanctions lifted. And now we have absolutely no leverage over the military and the government of Myanmar.
Do you think the U.S. was too enamored of Aung San Suu Kyi, Azim?
I think the world in general is very enamored with Aung San Suu Kyi, and I've been researching this issue for the last 5 years, and I've given presentations on this all over the world to governments and ministers and academics. And one of the difficulties that we have is that we have this thing called the Messiah complex. You know, we like to have our heroes on a pedestal and untarnished. Nobody wants to hear about the shortcomings of Nelson Mandela or Dr. King or Gandhi. And it's exactly the same thing with Aung San Suu Kyi. Her story is a very powerful story. You know, she's the daughter of one of the founding generals of Myanmar. She was jailed by her father's former colleagues. You know, she's Oxford educated, a Nobel laureate. She's beautiful, very articulate. And now she's out of prison, opening up her country to democracy and human rights and free markets. You know, this is a fantastic story. They even made a Hollywood movie out of this. And so when you insert her position on the Rohingyas and her indifference to the suffering of the Rohingya, it simply does not fit into the narrative that we in the West like to have. You know, and the fact is that Aung San Suu Kyi is no longer the Aung San Suu Kyi campaigner. She is now a politician. She has simply made a political calculation that it is simply no point in alienating the military by speaking up for the Rohingya. So this is a calculation that she has made that that there's little point in saying anything about the Rohingya. We should just let the military get on with what they do, and hopefully things will improve one way or another. And you know, she's much more interested in political power by the scheme of things at the moment.
Let me read a text from Mark who says, whether it's the Rohingya in Myanmar, the Uyghur in China, blacks in America, almost every nation has its own pet minority, that's in quotations there, who bear the brunt of the society's particular idiosyncrasies. The best thing to do is acknowledge this all too human propensity and attempt to suppress it within their respective legal codes. So there are certainly examples of this around the world. Gemma, let me go back to you, and I'm just curious about, are you concerned about a Rwanda-style genocide within Myanmar?
Yeah, massively. And I think any genocide experts as well will tell you it's a very, very serious concern, and literally they are on the brink. And I think what we will find when hopefully this calms down, hopefully it doesn't turn into complete massacre, is that actually the scale of what has happened already is so atrocious that you could take smaller massacres, I would say, individual ones, and they're of the same character completely, the same brutality and dehumanization. We're probably seeing small Rwandas taking place at the moment over and over, and if something is not done urgently, we're in for a huge bloodbath. This sadly, we might already find that some level of massacres have happened already over the past few weeks, and that is going to be shocking to the whole world when they hear. The reports we've had coming out from some villages are just too horrific for us to believe, even as activists at the moment, until we see the video evidence. But the stories that are coming out from the refugees are very consistent of a lot of people being killed, a lot of people being shot down with machine guns, and others burnt and others hacked. So, you know, when the dust settles, we'll hopefully get to some kind of truth on what has happened already. But yes, I mean, if nothing is done, this is where it's heading.
Azim, the subtitle of your book is Inside Myanmar's Hidden Genocide. Are you saying this genocide is taking place as we speak?
I believe so. And this is just not my definition. This is the definition of a number of legal experts, including Yale University, Human Rights Watch, Queen Mary University in London. You know, international legal experts have termed this as a genocide. It meets the entire criteria of a genocide. The difficulty is that it's not recognized as a genocide by the United Nations. The United Nations has its own definition, because when they term something as a genocide, it automatically triggers the Security Council to take a particular course of action according to the Genocide Convention. And you won't be surprised to learn that even Rwanda wasn't classified as a genocide, despite 850,000 people being killed, you know, being chopped up by machetes in 1 month, simply because the Security Council at the time did not want to take any action. And it's the same case here. You know, we have people arguing over the term genocide, but I believe that it certainly meets the criteria of a genocide. You know, this is a systematic, organized campaign to eliminate an ethnic minority group. and the government and military of Myanmar are doing everything possible to try to ensure that that happens.
Well, I'm thinking also about Bangladesh, which has been accepting, you know, thousands and thousands of refugees from Myanmar. Are they in a position, Azeem, to be able to care for these refugees? And some of the descriptions we read about what life is like inside these formal and then these informal camps is really pretty shocking.
Well, I visited the camps last year, and the conditions in the camps in Bangladesh are they're not much different from the camps actually inside Myanmar itself. The conditions are extremely horrific. You know, we have over 400,000 Rohingya refugees living in these camps in Bangladesh. And Bangladesh is a very poor country itself. It's having difficulty feeding its own people. You know, they're overpopulated as it is. So for them to absorb those kind of numbers is simply not feasible. And there's absolutely no reason why they actually should. You know, it is not their responsibility. The military of Myanmar actually wants all the Rohingya to go to a third country and countries like Bangladesh to take them in. But it's not the responsibility of the government of Bangladesh to take these people in. You know, they simply can't take those kind of numbers at all.
We're going to be talking to the first ambassador to Myanmar under the Obama administration in just a couple of minutes. Jamla, I'm giving you the final word. What would be your message to the United States?
To the United States, think about humanity. Please try and get some urgent protection for these people and urgent assistance at the Bangladeshi border. This is a catastrophe that has already happened and is getting worse. The world is starting to wake up about this. And you cannot afford to let another genocide just happen again and say, you know, you didn't know anything about it. It is taking place. It is escalating. So please, you know, take this matter seriously and do what you can to stop it.
Azeem, you've got 20 seconds. Final thoughts. Or final thought.
You know, I agree. You know, we have to make sure that Rwanda happened. 850,000 people were killed. And at the end of it, the world denied that they knew anything about it. This is now happening in real time. And I'm seeing footage and video myself. And we have to make sure as an international community and as Western countries, whether it's the US or UK or the European Union, that we are on the right side of history. Otherwise, you know, this will go.
Oh, we just lost him. That was Azeem Ibrahim, senior fellow at the Center for Global Policy, author of The Rohingyas, Inside Myanmar's Hidden Genocide. Azeem, thanks for joining us. Jamla Hanan, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Human rights activist, director of the crowdsourced hashtag We Are All Rohingya Now campaign. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. President Obama was the first U.S. president to visit Myanmar, which he did in 2012, praising the country and its opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi for its embrace of democracy. Today, Suu Kyi is now a government leader, and the country has been accused of grave human rights violations for its mistreatment of the Rohingya. We asked Derek Mitchell to join us, former ambassador to Burma or to Myanmar under President Obama and senior advisor to the Asia Center at the United States Institute of Peace. Ambassador Mitchell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Just a goodbye to our two guests who have been very concerned about what's been going on in Myanmar. They say there is a genocide happening in that country. Do you agree?
I agree. There are awful things happening on the ground. I spent countless hours trying to address what was a horrifying situation for this population, a stateless population in the corner of Burma, of Myanmar. And only recently we've seen in the headlines that they once again are on the move because of aggression against them. So whatever name you give it, it is an unacceptable human rights and humanitarian situation that the world must not look away from and must address.
And what must the world do?
Well, first and foremost, I mean, we have to understand the context in which this is happening. People of Burma have a very negative view. I mean, 95 or more percent of the people of that country do not view the Rohingya as legitimate citizens of the country.
Even though they've been living there for centuries.
They have. Some of them have. Many of them did come over during British colonialism, which was also a point of great sensitivity for the Burmese people. But there's a narrative that they have that they are illegal immigrants. They've come over recently from Bangladesh, that they're the front, the first wedge of an aggressive Islamic move to try to overwhelm Burma and maybe even have terrorist intentions. I mean, this is an overwhelming narrative of insecurity by the people of this country. So to understand that narrative, not to accept it, obviously, in its entirety, but to understand that narrative is at least to start to try to address it with the country. But the immediate issue is to try to protect these people, given that they are very, very vulnerable.
And how, again, how does the international community do that, or perhaps human rights organizations? I mean, there's certainly lots of organizations whose job it is to deal with people who are under threat or in refugee camps.
Right. I think you have to bear witness. You can't look away. You have to continue to bring this up in the UN. You have to bring it up with the Burmese government. You have to provide the humanitarian assistance and ensure that these people get the aid that they need and the dignity that they deserve. Ultimately, however, it is up to the people of Burma to figure this out and to work this out. They can't. There are a million or more people, Rohingya, in the country. They cannot get rid of a million people. They're going to have to figure out a way to live with them. Otherwise, they are going to get the attention of some of the worst actors in the world. There will be people, businesses around the world who will not do business with Burma. There will be cost to their desire to develop and be accepted as in the international community. So there are sort of normal, just natural ways that the international community can send its concern and support these people. But I think it's going to be up to the will of this government and the will of the people in Burma to understand what's at stake here and to do justice by these folks in their own interest.
You talk about the narrative that most people in Myanmar believe about the Rohingya. But is that narrative true? And is this the narrative that has been perpetrated, if I can put it that way, by the Burmese government?
Now, well, this is it's longstanding. The issue of Muslims in Burma is a longstanding point of friction, again, extending back to colonial times. It is an issue throughout the country, not just the Rohingya. There are other Muslims who are have rights abused, though the Rohingya are uniquely abused. Mm. You know, this is something that the narrative, I think, is incorrect in its entirety, that they are not illegal immigrants that mostly came over recently. But there was a group, the name Rohingya itself extends from an extreme separatist group that emerged right after World War II that sought to separate part of Rakhine State in Burma and attach itself to East Pakistan, now Bangladesh. So the name Rohingya does have historical connotations for many people in the country that talk about separatism and terrorism. You have to address those insecurities in order to deal with some of the facts of these individuals and deal with the dignity of these people.
This group called the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, they have attacked military installations or forces. They've killed people. How much do you think that feeds that narrative?
It absolutely feeds that narrative, and it's a very important point that's not talked about. We see the images, and it's important to see what's going on with these innocent Rohingya, mostly women and children, really, crossing the border. But this all started by the attack of this group, nicknamed ARSA, that basically goaded the military into overreacting, which the military, in its inimitable way, does. When it's attacked like that, it will overreact, and it will abuse people indiscriminately. There's no defending that, but this group attacked the day after the Kofi Annan's commission put out a report giving the Myanmar government a roadmap for dealing with this issue politically and peacefully. So just at the moment of opportunity where this could be dealt with by the government in a peaceful political fashion, this group attacked. So they are spoilers as well, and I think the international community needs to call them out. and need to condemn ARSA as part of the solution. Otherwise, we may embolden some of these groups to continue violence where violence is not the answer.
Let me quote something that Aung San Suu Kyi said. This is in the BBC this morning. And I'm just quoting here from the BBC, talking about what she describes and others have described as fake news photographs that have been circulating. This is Aung San Suu Kyi saying this is simply the tip of a huge iceberg of misinformation calculated to create a lot of problems between different communities and with the aim of promoting the interests of the terrorists. How do you see her? Obviously, she was someone that President Obama met when he visited Myanmar in 2012. How do you see her now as a civilian leader?
Well, first, let me address what she said. You can't broad brush all the information that's out there about abuses as being fake news, but she is accurate that there has been a lot of things posted in social media, things reported that were proving or proved to be inaccurate and inflammatory, things that were happening in Cambodia or other places around the world that were put up as abuses against the Rohingya. So I think the international community and those who want to promote the rights of the Rohingya need to be very careful that the information is solid and the evidence is strong. Otherwise, they can give license to the government to assert that everything is not as it seems. And that's number one. But number two, Aung San Suu Kyi. I've met dozens of times with her, with President Obama and on my own. I've talked to her specifically on this issue at length. I have no doubt in my mind she understands the complexities that are involved here and the responsibility of the government to address it. She is in a very, very difficult spot, in part because of where I started, which is the attitude of the average citizen against these people. There's no sympathy. There's no political benefit speaking up for those people who are viewed so negatively and so much as a threat to the security and identity of this country. She is also, even though she is the leader, she does not control the military and under the Constitution. So when there's an attack like ARSA committed, the military gets the advantage. They're the ones who will fight for the defense of the country, and she is reliant on them for information. So she has a very, very small space, small window to address this question in a responsible and principled way, which I really do believe she wants to. But it's difficult in that environment. It doesn't mean that she cannot speak out more. I do believe she can do more, but I do think that we have to be understanding more of her situation.
Well, what more do you think she can say? And I read a couple of quotes. I don't have them all, obviously. One of them was to deny that there was ethnic cleansing going on. Do you think she was correct about that? And if she can say more, and she has been criticized for not saying more, what can she say?
I think, you know, it's remarkable to think this, that a woman who has written so eloquently and spoken so eloquently on principles of democracy can actually not be a very effective political communicator.
Interesting.
I think she may not recognize that what she says, while technically may be correct, does not come across the way she wants it to. Ethnic cleansing, that's a term. It's like genocide.
Right.
They're sort of eye of the beholder. It's somewhat of an inflammatory term. I'm not going to say it is or isn't. It's very difficult to judge. But she does recognize that there is a severe problem and a humanitarian injustice and a human rights problem there, as I do, as everyone must. I think she's just technically saying that that term is inflammatory and not helpful. When she says it, the international community says, she's whitewashing it. She doesn't believe there's anything going on. So she calls out fake reports that is accurate, but it comes across as if she's whitewashing all reports of abuse. I don't believe that's what she means, but I think she's trying to be technically correct, and it's just not working for her internationally.
Are you concerned that Muslim terrorist organizations will use the mistreatment of the Rohingya as a recruitment tool?
I absolutely do. It's the thing that kept me up at night as ambassador. I worried about exactly the rise of something like ARSA, and there is very credible evidence that there is Saudi and Pakistani support for ARSA, and that, in fact, there may be some jihadist interest in ARSA, if not help for training and such. That's not to say ARSA is a jihadi organization, but there is credible evidence of outside support. And, you know, the issue of the Rohingya has become a cause celeb in the Middle East for good reason, because they are oppressed. They deserve attention. But it can attract the wrong kind of attention if we're not careful, and it can hurt not just the Rohingya, but everything we hope for in Burma, which is that Aung San Suu Kyi and her principles succeed, and that everything that I and President Obama had invested there is allowed to develop in the right direction.
Are you concerned with the crisis going on in Myanmar and the fact that so many people, so many Rohingya, are fleeing the country, going to places like Bangladesh, that it will destabilize the region, or is destabilizing the region?
Yes, and when Burma sometimes says that, you know, this is an internal issue, we always remind them it is not an internal issue, that refugee flows affect other countries and can destabilize other countries, and we saw that several years ago when there was a boat people crisis of Rohingya on boats in, you know, off to Malaysia or Thailand. This is, and as you say, it can cross border into Bangladesh. This is something they have to deal with as a regional issue. It can gain attention from jihadists in the Middle East towards Southeast Asia writ large, and you're seeing the rise of ISIS in Southeast Asia more generally, in places like the Philippines. So this is exactly what Southeast Asia does not need, is a place that is garnering this kind of attention from some of the worst actors in the world.
The military wants emergency powers. You know, they see this ARSA group as a threat to the government. Are you concerned about, if not a return to dictatorship in Myanmar, some loosening of some of the democratic freedoms that people have enjoyed in more recent years, maybe not the Rohingya, but others?
Mm-hmm. Yes. This is still a work in progress. It's an early period of democratic transition. The military allowed, shall we say, the election to happen and Aung San Suu Kyi to take power. They have the guns. They could have certainly held on if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. And I think they decided for many reasons, but one reason was, we'll give this a try and see if this democratic thing can work for the security of the country. And they may feel at a certain point that if the security is being negatively affected, they need to jump back in again. Mm-hmm. So I have always worried that a terrorist attack or lots of insecurity inside the country can lead the military to decide to jump back into politics again. I don't see it happening in the near term, but it's always a risk. You see it throughout Southeast Asia, that same concern.
Does U.S. have influence, have clout in Myanmar?
We do, in the sense that we went up to a point, of course. They're very proud, they're very nationalistic, and they were colonized, so they're not going to be told what to do by any outside power, particularly large outside powers. But we are very well regarded there. They think less of some of their neighbors, but they're very keen on the United States and what we represent. They opened up their arms to us when we opened to them as they started to reform. They want our investment. They want our support. They admire our values. And therefore, that gives us leverage that has to be carefully managed and carefully deployed in order to help them navigate some of these crises. But what they want most of all is to be understood. Again, they're very, very proud. And if they feel they're not understood, if we don't get it, as it were, then they're not going to listen to us. They're going to say, you don't understand. We have a problem here. And until you understand, we're just going to deal with it the way we know how to deal with it. So, again, if we give voice to people in Rakhine State who are suffering, as well as Rohingya, if we give voice to the insecurities they feel given the neighborhood they're in and their mindset about the onrush potentially of Islamic influence, if we're mindful generally of their situation, I think then we're more able to say, you know, there's a different way of dealing with this. The path you're on is actually going to lead to destruction. All the things you worry about for your country will happen if you deal with it through violence.
There's actually
a better path.
We're going to have to end our conversation there. Derek Mitchell, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
Former U.S. ambassador to Burma under President Obama. He's now a senior advisor at the Asia Center at the United States Institute of Peace, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, talking about the Rohingya and talking about Myanmar. That's it for today's edition of Radio Times. The engineer today, Diana Martinez. The show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.